I'm Kai Rizdahl, and this is a Marketplace special, The Tax Bill Now What? Thanks for coming along. There is some contextualizing to do at the outset here, a little bit of perspective given how fast this thing moved through the legislative process. Economists call it a baseline scenario. We are going to call it the Marketplace special version of our weekly wrap. Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. Don Lee is with the Los Angeles Times. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me start with you and ask you this question, if I can get a little bit Rumsfeldian with you here. We have a growing economy. We have basically full employment. And here we now have a massive tax cut bill. What are the unknowns as we think about the next sort of period in our economic lives?
So a few unknowns. One is, what will be the actual price tag of this bill in the long term? We have estimates from places like the Joint Committee on Taxation, from the Tax Policy Center, lots of experts. But we don't actually know what the final price tag will be for two reasons. One is that there are a lot of gimmicks in this bill, you know, provisions that expire, which could, if they are renewed, increase the total price tag. Additionally, the Joint Committee on Taxation sort of has to assume that the bill does what it's supposed to do and that there isn't a lot of exploitation of unintended loopholes. So we don't actually know what kinds of games accountants, tax attorneys will play that will ultimately reduce the revenue coming in because there are so many accidental glitches and drafting errors that occur in this bill. That's one major unknown.
That's one. And there will be many, many more. Don Lee, let me ask you this. Given how unpopular this bill is and how it was not a foundational premise of sort of the Trump presidency, are you surprised we made it this far?
I think this was clearly the top priority for the GOP. We know that one of the things that unifies the Republican Party and its long mantra has been tax cuts, especially for corporations. And I think there was a sense of urgency after they lost Obamacare reform and to undo that. And so there was a real strong sense of desperation, and that was clearly seen in just the swiftness of how they moved this through.
Catherine, you talked sort of about some longer term issues. We are going to be talking about this tax bill for the next 8 years. And I picked eight because the individual tax cuts in this bill expire, even though the GOP promises to extend them. We have now a prospect of, and I'm going to harken back a couple of years, another fiscal cliff as this thing nears its expiry date.
Yes, we do. And that's why I was saying earlier that this bill may ultimately cost more than the current estimates, because some of those expiring provisions, you know, especially on the individual side, will create this situation, this brinksmanship situation 8 years from now, where Congress has to decide, do we extend them? Do we suddenly allow them to expire as the bill is currently written and raise people's taxes? Do we add more to the debt by extending them? Mm-hmm. What kind of concessions get made? Yeah, I mean, we are definitely setting ourselves up for a huge showdown 8 years from now. And actually, to some extent, earlier than that, because there are other weird provisions that expire at other times.
Yeah, which we will find out about, you know, sort of in the next 8 to 10 months as people really read this bill and figure out what it actually means. Don Lee, let me ask you this, and it's the Obamacare comparison. And in the 30 seconds or so we have left, Obamacare was passed in 2010, became law. Here we are 7 years later. It's being essentially dismantled piece by piece. If the Democrats take back some part of Congress or the White House, what are the prospects for this tax bill being dismantled piece by piece?
I think that will be hard to do, obviously, with President Trump, if he's still in the office. And he will be for the next 3 years. And we know that you know, there's a good chance that Congress, that Republicans will lose seats. I mean, that's especially with an unpopular tax bill. So I think that could give Democrats some hope. But, you know, this is going to take a long time. Remember how long Obamacare took to get done. And I don't think that they're going to move with the kind of haste that the Republicans did.
Don Lee at the Los Angeles Times, Catherine Rampell at the Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
What One of the things we know about the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, which is what this thing is called, is that we don't really know a lot. Catherine and Don talked about that a little bit. We are going to talk about it a little bit more with a practitioner, a woman running a company in an economy where that baseline scenario I mentioned is about to change, conceivably a lot. Lisa Goldenberg is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania. We call her up from time to time to get a reality check. She is practically a marketplace regular herself. Lisa, it's good to have you back.
Great to be together. Thanks.
Last time we talked, you were hopeful, but not really counting on this tax bill getting done. And now here we are.
Yeah, look, I've been wrong before, but I don't know how wrong I really am, Kai. I'll tell you. Here we are. You know, the end of the program, we're going to have a tax bill and nobody knows what's in it. And there's so much horse trading going on till the last second. In preparation for our call, I think I've spoken to well over a dozen people and not a single one can tell me how it's going to affect them. Granted, I'm speaking to, you know, certainly the top 1%.
Sure.
But I've spoken to people in service industries, manufacturing, billion-dollar businesses, $2 million businesses, and yet not one person has said it's going to really help me.
Wow. I'll be honest with you. That is not what I expected to hear you say.
Me either, which is why I was so hopeful to get a tax bill passed. Of all the things I could hope in a Trump presidency, I really felt that I would stand behind this. And based on what I'm seeing, I can tell you for me personally, aside from the business, I have a wonderful second home. I'm going to lose everything that helps me to keep that. Right. I think it's really going to hurt real estate values. And I think the social programming that's getting paid for is going to get dropped in order to pay for some of this budget. And then it's going to get kicked to the states. We've already lost our state and local tax deduction. So it's going to hurt us even worse. State taxes are going to have to go up.
Talk to me for a second, though, about the business. You must be looking forward to your business and corporate taxes going down.
Corporate taxes are the effective tax rate are already really low. So I think that for certain businesses, I cannot tell you if it's going to affect mine in this way. For certain businesses, you are going to get an effective lowering. And in my opinion, perhaps use that for capital expenditure in an ideal reality. But as a dear friend said to me, Lisa, do you pay on performance or on tax savings? I can't see a corporation in America that's going to get a tax refund and say, you know what? I'm going to redo my whole pay structure based on this. No one's now going to get paid on performance. We're going to redo it based on tax reform. It's illogical.
You know what's funny is we talk on the program all the time about how businesses hate uncertainty. And here you are, a woman running a not small business, literally looking uncertainty in the face saying, yeah, I don't know.
What are you going to do? The stock market's happy. They're looking at the uncertainty and saying, well, we're going in the right direction. Because I think we have things that are on the table that are very important. How they leave the table is the uncertainty piece that people seem to be tolerating more and more. I think just with this administration, our ability for uncertainty is we're being stretched. Maybe we're maturing. I don't know. But business hates uncertainty, and yet look at the stock market.
Do you think, as the GOP has promised, that this is going to simplify your life in any way?
Well, if no one can answer what the tax code's going to do because it's so confusing, I can't see it simplifying in the short term. Will fewer tax brackets simplify the ability to, you know, handle taxes? Probably. I think that once we get through it, but we're talking about a 1,000-page bill. So even if you were inclined to read it, you wouldn't be well educated. You're not at the table. So what's simple about that?
Lisa Goldenberg at Delaware Steel. Lisa, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon.
You bet. Anytime.
The corporate tax cut got a big chunk of the attention as this bill was being written. But you, me, and the family down the block are all going to see some changes next year as well. So we've been asking over the past couple of weeks what you want to know about what's going to happen. We gathered up those questions, sent them off to Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, and she has been chasing down some of the answers for us. We're going to be checking in with her a couple of times throughout the show, tackling those questions one by one, starting right now. Hi, Tracy.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So coming out of that chat I just had with Lisa Goldenberg, we're going to do some questions about the corporate tax rate. First up, Jack Hayes, he's in Florida, wants us to look back a little bit into the 1900s. He wants to know what slice of annual federal government revenue comes from businesses now versus, say, in the 1950s, 1980s, you know, like decades ago?
So what we're talking about is the share of money flowing to the federal government that comes from companies. Jack asked about the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So that averaged about 27%. By the 1980s, that average had dropped to about 9%. And since then, since the 2000s, we've been about the same, about 10%. So remember, this isn't the tax rate. This is the amount of tax revenue that comes from businesses.
Right. Important to point out here as well that the government gets most of its money from us, right? From regular taxpayers as opposed to companies.
Right. Across that period, it's been about 40% from the income tax of revenue coming from income tax.
Okay. Perfect. So Tom Rhodes in Maryland, he wants to know about what actual rates companies pay, whether those are going to change, right? The rate is corporate rates going from 35 to 21%. They don't all pay that. What might happen here?
Yeah, the effective rate is when things get real. So our effective rate right now is something like 21%. To predict how that might change under this law, I had to get some help. So I called Ken Smetters at the Penn Wharton Budget Model. Ken's model spits out an effective corporate tax rate of 9% in 2018. 9%.
Yeah.
But because some of these provisions are front-loaded or they might expire, he thinks 10 years from now, that effective rate climbs back up to 18%. And so that's just, you know, a little bit lower than what we have now.
Okay, but let me ask you this question, because, and this is actually my own personal question, not a listener question. One of the things Republicans have been saying is, listen, if we get the corporate rate to 21% statutorily, that's going to bring business back here. But if I run a company and I can go to Ireland and pay 12% there, what does that mean? What's the global context of this?
Yeah, so it helps our competitiveness, but it doesn't solve the problem because, as you said, there's still going to be countries with lower effective rates. That's one point. The second point is this also comes from Ken Smetters at Penn. And I think this is really interesting and really important. So all the analysis from these of the GOT tax plan assumes other countries keep their tax rates right. The same. But he says, you know, that might not happen. There's something called tax competition.
If we lower our taxes, other countries may lower their taxes. If that were to happen, some of the benefits that we're assuming today are not going to be as great.
So all the calculations he and others done assume everyone else keeps the rates the same, but other countries just, they might not do that. They might respond with tax cuts of their own.
You squeeze the balloon one place, it pops out another place. That's the tax bill. All right, more from Tracy Samuelson later on in the program. Thanks, Trace.
Thanks, Guy.
The thing about economics is that what economists think is going to happen with this policy change or that, say, on taxes, might not look a whole lot like what actually happens, say, on taxes, once that policy gets put into practice. Lucky for us, then, we know a guy who knows both sides of that issue. Ed Fryer is a PhD economist. He used to teach it. Now he's a chicken farmer. He is the founder. Let me say that again. He's a chicken farmer. He's the founder and CEO of Ozark Mountain Poultry. Mr. Fryer, good to talk to you again, sir.
Hello, Kai. Good to talk to you.
So with your real-life experience combined with your academic economist background, I need to ask you a couple of questions. And the first one is, why does the Republican Party want to cut taxes at a time when the economy is doing reasonably well? Full employment, growing GDP, all those kinds of basics.
When you say reasonably well, the emphasis there should be on reasonably. We've been growing at about 2%. For most of this decade, and I think the economy has the potential to grow around 3%.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at 10 years into the future, the difference between 2% growth and 3% growth could easily be $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 of additional income for the typical family in the United States.
What's the root cause of that 2% sluggish growth? Is it just still a hangover from the Great Recession? What's going on?
I think it's a couple of things. One is we've had very low productivity growth so far this decade. And a second factor, and we've talked about this before, is kind of the animal spirits, the confidence. My father was a retired engineer. He had an MBA from the University of Chicago. And he and I used to talk almost every day, and our conversations usually were either about Razorback sports or business. And yeah, primarily business. We, you know, give us something positive to talk about.
Yeah.
But I remember back in the fourth quarter of 08 and the first quarter of 09, kind of at the depth of the Great Recession, the daily discussions were more centered around how do we survive this?
Yeah.
If Dad was here today and we were still having those conversations with the new regulatory environment and with this tax package, I think most of our conversations would be centered around how do we grow, not how do we survive.
Okay, so I get the confidence bit, the animal spirits bit that's going to come with a tax cut, right? The theory being companies are going to have more money, people are going to have more money. How does a tax cut improve worker productivity, though? Or is that not really what's going on here?
Labor productivity is driven by really either human capital or physical capital. I don't see anything in this tax package, at least from what I've been able to see, that's going to affect human capital in any important way. But the physical capital that's out there, I think the accelerated expensing and depreciation is going to make it easier, not just easier, but it's going to encourage companies to invest more in equipment and increase labor productivity.
Okay. Last time you and I spoke, we talked specifically about what you, as the guy running Ozark Mountain Poultry, is going to do with the extra money you're not paying in taxes. And I've spoken to other small business CEOs who say, absolutely, I'm going to pass it through, I'm going to invest it, and I'm going to put this money to work. What we see happen, though, at a lot of bigger companies, and I'm talking really big companies in this economy, is that the savings they get go to share buybacks, it goes to dividends, and it doesn't come out into the rest of the economy in the terms of investment and worker wages. What do we do if you and your colleagues on the smaller end of the scale are the only ones who actually spend this money?
Then I think we're right where we want to be. We get the additional growth. So to me, the key to this whole thing is how do pass-throughs respond to it? Mm-hmm. And that's what I've been trying to get my hands around. I know this thing is going to stimulate growth in the economy. It already has. Over the weekend, I intended to print out the pages dealing with pass-through organizations, and instead of hitting print for a specific range of pages, I printed out all 1,000 pages. So I've already jump-started the economy, inadvertently.
One of the things, two things that Republican leaders on the Hill and in the White House are saying is this bill is going to boost economic growth so much so that it is going to pay for itself. Are you sanguine that these tax cuts will pay for themselves?
Again, I go back to the 2% growth mm-hmm. versus 3% growth. That difference in the growth, it's just amazing what a fundamental change that will make in the U.S. economy.
What happens, though, Mr. Fryer, if the economy doesn't grow, if we stay stuck at this 2%?
Then we've got a problem because all we've done is increase the national debt and the deficit. Growth is the key to this. If we don't get the growth, then there's a problem. I think by this time next year, if we're not averaging 3% growth by this time next year, I'm going to have second thoughts about my whole analysis.
All right. Well, we'll call you up. We'll talk about it. Ed Fryer at Ozark Mountain Poultry. We got him in Rogers, Arkansas, as we always do. Sir, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
All right. We'll see you, Kai. Thanks.
We talk about the tax bill sometimes in kind of an antiseptic way, right? Deductions here, loopholes there, this or that pass-through, just like Mr. Fryer and I were talking about. Fact is, though, the tax policy is really a way for the government to push us to do or not do certain things. And those things that are being incentivized, to use an economic term, or disincentivized, are going to change with this new bill. Marketplace's Spree Beneshore has been looking at that one. Hey.
Hey there.
So there is a word that a lot of people use for the tax code. Social engineering is what a lot of people call it. You buy that?
Absolutely. It's like the Matrix. It's all around us. there's actually agreement on this across the political spectrum. Examples. When your employer sets aside some of your income for retirement, that's not taxed. Why is that? That is because the government wants you to save for retirement, so it doesn't have to support you as much later. We see it in education. There are 529 savings accounts, savings for college, tax deductible. Why is that? Well, to get more people to go to college. It helps the labor force be more competitive. Another one is the earned income tax credit. This is a tax credit for very poor families. It's a tax credit that gives them extra money the more they work. Why do you suppose that is? That is to get them to work more. It appeals to people who are, you know, concerned they might stay on welfare.
Right. Some of those that you just mentioned are not without controversy, shall we say. Has it always been that the government nudges us this way or that?
Well, we've actually had liquor taxes since 1791, which some people wanted to discourage what they thought was socially destructive behavior. But really, when you see the tax code start to be a behavioral instrument, it's after World War II. Here's Bill Gale with the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
During World War II, the income tax was changed from what's sometimes called a class tax that only affected a relatively few high-income households to what's called a mass tax that affected the majority of households in the country. Obviously, that was done to help finance the war effort.
Yeah, so once you had a lot more people paying taxes, you had a lot more voices asking for tax breaks. But this is where I would caution people against thinking that everything in the tax code that does incentivize some behavior was designed, always that way, was designed by some sort of grand master of planning of days gone by. Some of these incentives, they just kind of happened. So, for example, the home mortgage interest deduction, it does incentivize home buying for Americans who can buy homes, but it didn't start that way. This was a point that Stephen Bank made to me. He teaches law at UCLA.
The modern income tax starting in 1913 had a deduction for interest. It was deduction for interest generally. In 1986, that was peeled back considerably, but they left the home mortgage interest. So, you know, was there a special preference for home buying starting in 1913? Not really, but it became one.
Yeah, another way of thinking about this is just think about what behaviors do these incentives reinforce. Getting married, buying a house, having kids, sending those kids to college, retiring. Is the tax code incentivizing that, or is it just recognizing that that's what a lot of people want to do?
Yeah, that's a fair point. And you know, the mortgage interest thing is interesting because that's going away in part now with this bill. A lot of people are screaming about that. And so you see how that's controversial. Let me ask you this, though. The tax code, as we have seen this year, is just monstrously difficult to negotiate, let alone completely overhaul. Aren't there easier ways to do what is being done here?
Yeah, for sure. But that's the whole point. You can sneak things in through the tax code. It's like a back door. The Stephen Bank again.
It's kind of under the radar. Now, that's odd to say. The tax bill is obviously in the news all the time. But it's really hard for people to keep track of exactly what's going on. There's a lot of moving parts. It's definitely one of those shell games you might see like on the boardwalk in Atlantic City or something like that.
So, for example, let's take the home mortgage interest deduction that we've just been talking about. We could, instead of giving people this deduction, we could, as a country, just mail everyone who's buying a house a check. That might not go over so well. This is Michael Strain, Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute.
If that program had to be annually appropriated, it would not continue. If members of Congress had to take to the floor and say, yes, I support giving a government subsidy to the owners of large, expensive, debt-financed homes, they wouldn't do it.
Yeah, so his point is that, you know, you make something take the form of a tax deduction or tax credit, it's easier to swallow.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. There's a politics part of this thing, right? This bill was largely written by free market conservatives, Paul Ryan and Kevin Brady, chief among them, in the House of Representatives. They are not always wild about using government for social engineering, which is where we started. Does this bill then get us away from the tax code of social engineering?
Yes, a little bit. So to go back to the home mortgage interest deduction, this bill limits the amount you can deduct. You can only deduct interest on the first $750,000 of your home. That number used to be $1 million. So it's not rewarding or incentivizing home ownership of more expensive homes as much as we used to. Another way it cuts down on incentives is by raising the standard deduction. So normally, up until now, a lot of people, when they do their taxes, they might go itemize and they say, oh, here's a deduction for donating to charity. I'll donate to charity. Here's a deduction for doing something else. Yeah. I'll do that thing. Instead, you can just ignore all those deductions and say, I'm going to do this automatic standard deduction. It's easy. Well, that takes away the incentivizing power of certain deductions. One last one for you. Mm-hmm. It limits how much state and local taxes you can deduct.
Right.
And when you can't deduct those taxes as much as you used to, you become more sensitive and maybe you become less tolerant of state and local taxes. So this influences the behavior of local governments. It doesn't make it easy anymore to spend as much and raise taxes. Makes that harder.
Right. Last thing, and then I'll let you go. There is still, though, a little bit of that social engineering thing that we talked about left in this bill. I mean, it's not completely gone.
Yeah, totally. Totally. For example, it increased the child tax credit. So basically, people who have kids get more. It allows you to deduct the money you save to put your kids through private schools, including religious schools. That is a clear incentive. That's government approval for putting kids in private schools. One last one is taxes on certain types of businesses, pass-through businesses. Those go way down. That creates an incentive, ideally, for people to start businesses, though that's kind of controversial.
Marketplace is Bree Benishore in our New York office with what you can only call a tour de force of the tax code as social engineering. So, Bree, thanks.
My pleasure.
We're going to go back to Tracy Samuelson here for a minute. Listener questions round two. Kansas has gotten a bunch of fiscal policy attention the past 5 or 6 years. Tax cuts it passed in 2012 along the lines of what the national GOP has done with this tax bill. Trickle-down economics is what it's basically called. Tracy, Doug Rush in Indiana, he wants to know how relevant those comparisons are. So maybe first what you got to do is remind us exactly what Kansas did.
Yeah. So starting at the beginning in 2012, Kansas cut income taxes across the board. They reduced their number of income brackets. But one of the biggest things that they did was to totally eliminate taxes for pass-through businesses. So these are businesses that might be owned by one or two people where the profits are passed through to the owner. So they're often described as small businesses. They actually can be quite big, like a big law firm, for example. But what Kansas did was cut their taxes to zero. Kansas Governor Sam Brownback promised it would be, quote, a shot of adrenaline for the Kansas economy. So this was a program really sold on economic growth.
Right. And let's remember, that's exactly what the national plan does. It doesn't cut it to zero, but it drastically cuts rates on pass-through businesses. And it's part of that whole trickle-down thing. So what happened in Kansas?
Okay, so Kansas, their economy grew slower than neighboring states. The promised jobs didn't materialize. The state's credit was downgraded. Its revenue plummeted. Lots of people reclassified themselves as pass-through businesses. No surprise, you take away taxes there. Suddenly, everyone wants to be a pass-through business.
Yeah.
Bottom line, it wasn't a success. I called up a public finance professor in Kansas, Kenneth Kriz. He's at Wichita State University, and here's how he kind of summed it up.
By the end of fiscal year 2016, the state was effectively, I hate to use the term bankrupt, but if it was a private organization, it would be considered bankrupt.
And so in June of this year, Kansas ended up raising taxes. Basically, it had a projected two-year $900 million revenue gap it needed to close.
With the caveat that Sam Brownback, the governor of Kansas, was on Capitol Hill like a month ago talking about how Congress ought to do what Kansas did, how good a proxy is Kansas for the bill that we now have?
Kansas it's a cautionary tale in a lot of ways. So basically, when you hear people saying that cutting taxes is going to spur economic growth and that extra growth will create all this revenue that will make up for or minimize the loss in tax revenue, you know, Kansas might say, buyer beware. The promised economic growth in Kansas did not materialize. Here's Ken Kriz again.
The best estimates that we have indicates that it creates a little bit of economic growth, but not for very long. Typically, it's a 1 to 2 year. I think somebody once called it a sugar high. You get a sugar high, and then it comes crashing down.
But there are differences between Kansas and the federal government's plan. So one is that Kansas has to balance its budget. Congress, you know, they can add over $1 trillion to the national debt. Kansas had to do some pretty dramatic and painful spending cuts. Another difference is, you know, while the GOP, as you mentioned, the GOP plan drops taxes for pass-through businesses. It doesn't eliminate them, so that's not nearly as dramatic.
Right.
And the Kansas plan, it didn't touch the broader corporate tax rate. So there are definite details in the specifics, and the specifics matter here.
Yeah, they totally do. And just to back to that point that Ken Criz mentioned about economic growth, we should say here that the GOP is banking on, and they say have said repeatedly, that this plan that is now set to become law is going to have a lot of economic growth in it, which is going to help us pay for it. All right, so moving on now, Kansas to Alaska. Ann Fuller wants to know when all of these provisions are going to kick in. Does she have to worry about this coming April when she pays her taxes?
Yeah, the short answer is no. Most provisions take effect January 1st, meaning the taxes you pay in April, remember, that's income you earned in 2017. So, no, that won't be affected. But kind of interesting, there are some people who are scrambling now because these provisions don't take effect until next year. So starting in 2018, for example, mm-hmm. you know, couples filing jointly can't deduct more than $10,000 worth of state and local income, sales, and property tax. That starts in 2018. So some people are thinking, what if I prepay some of my property taxes so I can take advantage of those deductions in 2017?
Literally wrote to my accountant this morning asking that very question. True story. True story.
Okay, well, there you go.
Tracy,
giving
Samuels
the government your money early.
That's right. Giving the government my money early. Go figure that one out. Tracy's back in a bit with one more round. Thanks, Tracy.
Thanks, Guy.
So far this hour, we have talked about what the bill might mean for companies, what it might mean in terms of what we do or don't do economically. With Sabrine, now we are going to get down to brass tacks, what it might mean for you and your money. A lot of things factor into your ultimate tax bill, right? Where you live, whether you own or rent, the makeup of your family. One thing, though, is going to become especially important on January 1st, how you make your money. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is here to explain that. Hey.
Hi, Kai.
So a lot of people are going to need to do some calculations here in terms of what makes sense for them starting the 1st of January. And it's got a lot of people talking about the differences between wage workers, right? People who work for a company and get a paycheck compared to small business owners and independent contractors. So lay it out for me.
So this is all about pass-through businesses. You and Tracy were just talking about this. These are the types of businesses where the owners pay regular income taxes on the profits of their businesses. Those profits pass through to their income taxes. And actually, the vast majority of American businesses are these kinds of businesses. It's not just like a business with workers. It can also be an independent contractor or somebody working in the gig economy, a freelancer, an Uber driver. And in under this tax bill, depending on what you do, you may get a lower tax rate as an independent contractor as opposed to a regular employee.
Help me understand that a little bit, the whole thing about what you do.
Right. So under this bill, what really matters is the kind of pass-through business you're in. Now, let's keep in mind, under the tax bill, the pass-through business income that you get, you can deduct 20% of it. And that ends up being giving you a lower rate than the top tax rate, which is 37%. Ryan Alexander is president of Taxpayers for Common Sense. And here's how she lays this out.
There's a set of favored business activities and disfavored business activities in the pass-through rules. And I think that there will be shifts in both of those groups. If you're in a favored activity industry, you're going to certainly look at shifting from being an employee to being a partner or an independent contractor.
Okay, so what does that mean? So, for example, a construction worker who's in a favored industry might end up with a lower tax rate as an independent contractor instead of working for a construction company. On the other hand, if you're a doctor or a lawyer, which landed in the unfavored industry category, it may be better for you to be a partner or owner, or maybe just relabel your business as something else entirely, like a real estate company.
Is it possible then? Let's get back to the construction worker, right? If one person working construction sets him or herself up as a pass-through independent contractor and the other one takes a paycheck from the company, you could have two people doing basically the same job, getting paying different tax rates and thus taking home different amounts of money.
Yep, you certainly could. This bill has some guardrails in it to try and limit people from reclassifying themselves just for the sake of lowering their tax bill. For example, there's an income cap on the eligible income you can have to still get that pass-through deduction. Right. But on the other hand, Ryan Alexander says there's probably going to be a bunch of those situations.
I'm going to say that if you're a wage earner and you're sitting next to someone who's doing the same thing you're doing and just paying less taxes because their job is structured differently on paper, I think you're just going to be mad.
Yeah. On the other hand, it's important to keep in mind that as a wage earner, as an employee, you're going to get benefits that an independent contractor will not, such as health care benefits. Who knows, maybe child care or transportation benefits. And having been an independent contractor myself in the past, I can tell you that paperwork is absolutely no fun to do, especially when it comes to taxes. So even though it may lower people's tax rate to reorganize their businesses or their lives, it's not the only consideration that people are going to have.
Right. And as always, consult your own financial professional. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams in our Washington Bureau on the whole pass-through provisions of this bill and so much more. Kimberly, thanks.
You're welcome, Kai.
All right, so kind of picking up where Kimberly and I left off, one of the big picture things to talk about with this bill in the next 10 or so years in this economy is what it's going to mean for economic mobility, how people move up or sometimes down the economic ladder, specifically people at the lower end. Dorothy Brown is a professor of law at Emory University, where she studies tax policy and race in this economy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me get your sense, first of all, ma'am, of I guess your gut take on this tax bill.
Well, it's a giveaway to high-income taxpayers. When you have the corporate tax cut as the centerpiece of legislation, we know that that's going to be received disproportionately by the shareholders who are upper-income Americans.
And they are also, and the reason we're talking to you, mostly white Americans, right?
Absolutely. So this tax bill is going to increase our black-white wealth gap.
Explain that a little bit for me. Tell me more about how that's going to be manifested in this tax bill.
So if you have tax breaks that are going to taxpayers who are disproportionately higher income and wealthier, they're going to wind up keeping money in their pockets, whereas black taxpayers who don't also get the same benefits are going to wind up paying more taxes, or certainly not getting the tax cut and being able to save to the extent that white taxpayers are.
And this is a continuation of tax policy in this country for decades, going on a century, I'm sure now.
Absolutely.
Of the compounding of white wealth at the cost of minority and folks of color wealth, right?
That's absolutely right. And the tax code has been part of the problem, but it's been one that has not been paid too much attention to. Of course, it's something I spend a lot of my time doing, but
yeah,
I'm one of the few.
Is it
not the only?
I was going to ask you your sense of whether or not people who are making this law understand the racial and minority implications of it. But my guess is your answer would be no, they don't.
I don't either. They don't know, or they just don't care. Because let's be clear: when you center a corporate tax cut, you do not think you're helping Black Americans by doing that, right? It just doesn't make sense. So you know who shareholders are. You know who you're benefiting. Maybe you could say race is invisible, but it's really not a secret.
Well, the response will be, if I could put words in Republicans' mouth, they will say, listen, we're just doing this by income bracket and by, you know, the folks who are generating the economic growth in this country, corporate America.
Except the progressive tax system is designed to hit those at the highest income levels the hardest. That's by design of what the progressive tax system is supposed to do. This tax bill turns that on its head.
They will also say, if I might continue speaking for the Republican Party here, it's all going to trickle down. Professor Brown, don't worry about it.
It is not, because corporations are not hurting for money at this point, or I should say different industries, right? Retail may be hurting, but Apple, GE, they're not hurting. We have lots of corporations that have over $1 trillion in reserves. Additional tax cuts aren't going to make them hire workers. Demand is going to make them hire workers. And until you have higher consumer demand, which you could do if you generated tax cuts for the middle class, significant tax cuts for the middle class, which is not what this bill did, that's just a pipe dream.
Let me turn the page for a second, as Speaker Ryan has done, to what he wants to get done in the next year now that taxes are done. Speaker Ryan has talked about Medicaid and Medicare reform, Social Security reform, and getting rid of the debt burden that this tax bill imposes
they
on the country.
They just created by that, enacting this tax bill.
So what is when you hear him say Medicaid and Medicare reform, what does that translate into in your ears?
It translates into some of the most vulnerable Americans are going to be disadvantaged by this Republican tax bill. This has always been part one. Part one was the tax cuts so that they can say, oh, look at this awful deficit, by the way, that the Republicans just created with this tax bill. We have to cut our spending. And it's going to be the most vulnerable among us that are going to bear the brunt of that.
Let me, for the third time in this interview, let me speak for the Republican Party and Speaker Ryan. If he were here, he would say, listen, Professor Brown, we want to give states the ability to control the money. We're going to give them block grants to take care of Medicare and Medicaid, and we're going to let the states figure it out. What can be wrong with that?
What can be wrong with that is states are under significant financial distress from other federal government cutbacks. So states do a lot, but they have limited ability to raise taxes. They can't, you know, go into session and hike taxes the way the Republicans just did. So by putting another burden on states, you're going to see those without voices being disadvantaged.
I will tell you, just since I spoke for him, we have invited Speaker Ryan on Marketplace. I can't even tell you how many times. So we're here when he is. Dorothy Brown, professor of law at Emory University. Ma'am, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
All right. One more time. One more set of your questions. Tracy Samuelson is back. We are talking debt this time. Christian Wiswell from Washington State, Tracy, asks this. When the debt goes up by $1 trillion or more, as it will under this bill, to whom do we owe all of that money? Tracy?
Okay. Quick primer on the national debt.
Yes.
The U.S. national debt is about $20 trillion right now, a little more than that, growing every day. There are two pieces of it. The smaller piece, about $5 trillion, is intra-government debt, which is, you know, for example, if a pension or a state government invests in treasuries mm-hmm. from security, that's one small piece. The bigger piece, $15 trillion, is public debt. So that public debt, you know, treasury, they create a bond, they take it to auction. Who buys that? Right now, typically about 40% of buyers are international, whether that's investors, institutions, governments. The top countries are, no surprise, can you guess, China, also Japan. And so our new debt will look probably a lot like our old debt, just, you know, a lot more of it. It's unlikely that, you know, this additional debt would cause investors to doubt our ability to pay it or that they wouldn't buy it. Maybe they might maybe look for a little bit more interest on that debt.
Right.
We kind of have to wait and see.
Right. And you know, the bond market is showing it, right? The rate, not to get all wonky, but the rate on the 10-year Treasury note has been going up. All right. Lots of extra debt. Lots of question from listeners about how that might affect future spending. Tim Jacobson wants to know how Social Security spending might be affected over the next 10 or so years. Tracy?
Yeah, I'm actually going to take this and look at Social Security and entitlements in general.
Medicare and Medicaid and all of that, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So probably this won't affect Social Security, at least not directly, but it could put pressure on these other entitlement programs. So earlier this month, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan did an interview with a libertarian talk show host, and he said cutting entitlements is a way to deal with the growing deficit. He was talking about Obamacare, welfare reform. Then the host asked specifically about Social Security. He didn't say no, but he sort of redirected back to focus on health care and Medicare. So probably this won't affect Social Security, again, at least not directly, but it could put pressure on these other programs.
Give me a super, super quick riff here on this thing we've been hearing about called PAYGO, pay-as-you-go.
Yeah. So back in 2010, Congress basically said, if we're going to start spending, if we're going to increase the national debt, we're going to trigger some automatic cuts in other places. So Social Security is protected from those cuts, but food stamps, welfare, Medicare, they are subject to those cuts. It's unclear yet whether that will be in play here. Speaker Ryan and House Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said don't worry, we're going to waive this provision. Congress actually does that a lot, but Democrats will need to vote to make that happen.
Just when you thought the tax bill was done, it is really not. Tracy Samuelson out of our New York Bureau has been doing all the heavy lifting on all these questions. Thank you, Tracy, so much for taking the time.
No problem. Thanks, Guy.
Much, and I do mean much, has been made of the fact that this is the first tax overhaul this economy has seen since 1986. 31 years, if you're counting, which is a long time in the life of an economy. Just think about what's changed since the mid-Reagan years, right? It's a long time in the life of a person, too. So we've called two people born the same year as the Reagan tax cuts, two people still relatively early in their working lives, to find out what they are expecting out of this bill. Catherine Unger-Peer lives in Norwood, Massachusetts. That's north of Boston. Stephen Harrell is in Dallas, Texas. Thanks so much for coming on. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Do me a favor, would you, Catherine, and you get to go first. Tell me a little bit about your economic self, would you, your economic life?
I work for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, so I have a fairly modest income. My husband works for a software company in Boston, so he has a little bit more money than I do. And together, we make approximately $120,000 a year or thereabouts. So we're doing pretty well for people in our age group.
Yeah, and do you feel pretty good? I mean, is your own personal economy doing all right?
For the most part, only just because we don't ever spend anything. So most economic or people might think that we're not doing our part, right?
Well, we should say here you're expecting a baby, right? So your expenses are going to go up.
Yeah, so we're prepping for that and saving a lot of money for that.
All right. Stephen, same question to you. What is your economic life like?
My wife and I, we have three boys, ages 6, about to be 5, and just turned 3.
Wow.
And so my wife stays home with the three of them doing everything that they need to do. So she definitely works harder than I do. But does not get paid for it. So our economic life is that we are a single income family.
Yeah. At what kind of dollar level? Give me some kind of range.
Yeah, sure thing. So I actually looked it up for the 2016 tax return because I did not want to misrepresent.
Yeah.
So adjusted gross income for 2016 was $54,816.
For a family of 5.
Mm-hmm.
How you feeling economically?
We feel a lot better than we used to. Graduating with an English degree in May of 2009 was not the best economic decision that anybody's ever made.
Yeah.
But the economy bounced back eventually, so we are feeling better than we have in the course of our marriage.
In a while, yeah. Catherine, how closely have you been paying attention to this tax bill and what it may or may not mean for your family?
I've been paying somewhat close attention to it just because I find myself in the minority of Americans and that I enjoy doing my taxes. So I was definitely interested to see how this was actually going to impact us. So it looks like more or less the impact of this is going to be a wash for us. It's not going to be, you know, the huge tax cut that all the Republicans are saying that's going to be.
Stephen, you're smack in that demographic and that tax bracket where you should be seeing some good out of this tax overhaul bill. Are you feeling that? Are you banking on it?
Banking on it would not be the right way to describe it, I don't think. I've looked at it and I keep hearing about, you know, the lower middle class, like tax effects of it that would be positive. And I mean, as far as I can tell through the calculators and everything like that online, there's maybe a couple $100 extra in the child tax credit that is now refundable that wasn't before.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're talking $600 a year, $900 a year, I guess.
You both are young people, reasonably new to sort of getting by in this economy, right? You both have about a decade or so of your working lives behind you and probably another, you know, 35 to go. What do we do if this is the last tax overhaul for the next 31 years, like it was since the year y'all were born? Catherine?
I think we'll end up in a little bit of a pickle just because so many of the current tax cuts are set to expire in the not so distant future just for deficit purposes. And so we'll end up paying more in taxes in the long run. So it seems unlikely that this is going to be the last one in the next 35 years. Huh. but maybe it is. And maybe we're just stuck with whatever we're currently making now.
Stephen, how much of it, how much of a problem is it for you? Is it a problem at all that this bill adds $1.5 trillion to the deficit?
You know, deficits generally do not keep me up at night, but using deficits as a reason to go after and cut from social services and government programs that benefit the lower and middle class, that will be a problem.
Stephen Harrell in Dallas, Texas, Catherine Unger Pier up near Boston. Thank you both. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
That is all we got. Thank you so much for joining us for this Marketplace Tax Bill special. Now what? We got more answers to the tax questions that you have at marketplace.org. Also, more coverage online and across all of our programs. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thanks again for listening.